The Building. From the Unpublished Voyages to Kok, Rehek, and Jig by Thomas et al., with the kind permission of the author. The Plain of Kok is unusual in having two rational or more or less rational species. The Dako are stocky, greenish-tan-colored humanoids. The Ok are taller and a little greener than the Dako. The two species, though diverged from a common simioid ancestor, cannot interbreed. Something over 4,000 years ago, the Dako had what the Planar Encyclopedia refers to as an EEPT, a period of explosive expansion of population and technology. Before it, the two species had seldom come in contact. The Ok inhabited the southern continent. The Dako were in the northern hemisphere. The Dako population escalated, spreading out over the three land masses of the northern hemisphere, and then to the south. As they conquered their world, they incidentally conquered the Ok. The Dako attempted to use the Ok as slaves for domestic or factory work, but failed. It seems the Ok, though unaggressive, do not take orders. During the height of the EEPT, the most expansive Dako nations pursued a policy of slaughtering the primitive and unteachable Ok in the name of progress. Settlers of the equatorial zone pushed the remnant Ok populations farther south yet into the deserts and the barely habitable cane breaks of the coast. All species on Kok, except a few pests and the insuperable and indifferent bacteria, suffered badly during and after the Dako EEPT. In the final eco-catastrophe, the Dako population dropped by 4 billion in 4 decades. The species has survived, living on a modest scale, vastly reduced in numbers and more interested in survival than dominion. As for the Ok, probably very few, perhaps only hundreds, survived the rapid destruction and final ruin of the planet's life web. Descent from this limited genetic source may help explain the prevalence of certain traits among the Ok, but the cultural expression of these tendencies is inexplicable in its uniformity. We don't know much about what they were like before the crash, but their reputed refusal to carry out the other species' orders suggests that they were already working, as it were, under orders of their own. There are now about 2 million Dako, mostly on the coasts of the south and the northwest continents. They live in small cities, towns, and farms, and carry on agriculture and commerce. Their technology is efficient but modest, limited both by the exhaustion of their world's resources and by strict religious sanctions. There are probably 15,000 or 20,000 Ok, all on the southern continent. They live as gatherers and fishers, with some limited casual agriculture. The only one of their domesticated animals to survive the die-offs is the Boos, a clever creature descended from pack-hunting carnivores. The Ok hunted with Boos when there were animals to hunt. Since the crash, they use Boos to carry or haul light loads, as companions and in hard times as food. Ok villages are movable. From time immemorial, their houses have been fabric domes stretched on a frame of light poles or canes, easy to set up, dismantle, and transport. The tall cane which grows in the swampy lakes of the desert and all along the coasts of the equatorial zone of the southern continent is their staple. They gather the young shoots for food, spin and weave the fiber into cloth, and make rope, baskets, and tools from the stems. When they have used up all the cane in a region, they pick up the village and move on. The cane plants regenerate from the root system in a few years. The Ok have kept pretty much to the desert and canebrake habitat enforced upon them by the Dako in earlier millennia. Some, however, camp around outside Dako towns and engage in a little barter and filching. The Dako trade with them for their fine canvas and baskets and tolerate their thievery to a surprising degree. Indeed, the Dako attitude to the Ok is hard to define. Wariness is part of it. A kind of unease that is not suspicion or distrust, A watchfulness that surprisingly stops short of animosity or contempt and may even become conciliating. It is even harder to say what the Auk think of the Dako. The two populations communicate in a pidgin or jargon containing elements from both languages, but it appears that no individual ever learns the other species' language. The two species seem to have settled on coexistence without relationship. They have nothing to do with each other except for these occasional, slightly abrasive contacts at the edges of southern Dako settlements, and a limited, very strange collaboration having to do with what I can only call the specific obsession of the Auk. I'm not comfortable with the phrase specific obsession, but cultural instinct is worse. At about 2.5 or 3 years old, Auk babies begin building. Whatever comes into their little greeny bronze hands that can possibly serve as a block or brick, they pile up into houses. The Auk use the same word for these miniature structures as for the fragile cane and canvas domes they live in, but there is no resemblance except that both are roofed enclosures with a door. The children's houses are rectangular, flat-roofed, and always made of solid, heavy materials. They are not imitations of Dako houses, or only at a very great remove, since most of these children have never been to a Dako town, never seen a Dako building. It is hard to believe that they imitate one another with such unanimity that they never vary the plan. But it is even harder to believe that their building style, like that of insects, is innate. As the children get older and more skillful, they build larger constructions, though still no more than knee-high, with passages, courtyards, and sometimes towers. Many children spend all their free time gathering rocks or making mud bricks and building houses. They do not populate their buildings with toy people or animals or tell stories about them. They just build them with evident pleasure and satisfaction. By the age of 6 or 7, some children begin to leave off building, but others go on working together with other children, often under the guidance of interested adults, to make houses of considerable complexity, though still not large enough for anyone to live in. The children do not play in them. When the village picks up and moves to a new gathering ground or canebrake, these children leave their constructions behind without any sign of distress. As soon as they are settled, they begin building again, often cannibalizing stones or bricks from the houses a previous generation left on the site. Popular gathering sites are marked by dozens or hundreds of solidly built miniature ruins, populated only by the joint-legged gikoto of the marshes or the little rat-like hikiki of the desert. No such ruins have been found in areas where the Auk lived before the Dako conquest. Evidently, their propensity to build was less strong or didn't exist before the conquest or before the crash. 2 or 3 years after their ceremonies of adolescence, some of the young people, those who went on building houses until they reached puberty, will go on their first stone faring. A stone faring sets out once a year from the Auk territories. The complete journey takes from 2 to 3 years, after which the travelers return to their natal village for 5 or 6 years. Some Auk never go stone faring. Others go once. Some go several or many times in their life. The route of the stone farings is to the coast of Rakim on the northeast continent and back to the Madeiro, a rocky plateau far inland from the southernmost canebrakes of the great south continent. The Auk stone farers gather in spring, coming overland or by cane raft from their various villages to Gatbam, a small port near the equator on the west coast. There, a fleet of cane and canvas sailboats awaits them. The sailors and navigators are all Dako of the south continent. They are professional sailors, mostly fishermen. Some of them sail the faring every year for decades. The Auk pilgrims have nothing to pay them with, arriving with provisions for the journey, but nothing else. While at Rakim, the Dako sailors will net and salt fish from those rich waters, a catch which makes their journey profitable. But they never go to fish off Rakim except with the stone-faring fleet. The journey takes several weeks. The voyage north is the dangerous one, made early in the year so that the return voyage carrying the cargo may be made at the optimal time. Now and then boats or even whole fleets are lost in the wild tropical storms of that wide sea. As soon as they disembark on the stony shores of Rakim, the Ak get to work. Under the direction of senior stonefarers, the novices set up domed tents, store their sparse provisions, take up the tools left there by the last pilgrimage, and climb the steep green cliffs to the quarries. Rikimite is a lustrous, fine-textured greenish stone with a tendency to cleave along a plane. It can be sawed in blocks or split into stone planks or smaller tiles, and even into sheets so thin they are translucent. Though relatively light, it is stone, and a 10-meter canvas sailboat can't carry great quantities of it, so the stonefarers carefully gauge the amount they quarry. They rough-shape the blocks at Rakim and even do some of the fine cutting, so that the boats carry as little waste as possible. They work fast, since they want to start home in the calm season around the solstice. When their work is complete, they run up a flag on a high pole on the cliffs to signal the Dako fleet, which comes in boat by boat over the next few days. They load the stone aboard under the tubs of salted fish and set sail back south. The boats put in at one Dako port or another, usually the crew's home port, to unload and sell their fish. Then they all sail on several hundred kilometers down the coast to Gast, a long, shallow harbor in the hot marshlands south of the canebrake country. There the sailors help the Ak unload the stone. They receive no payment for or profit from this part of the trip. I asked a shipmaster who had sailed the fairing many times why she and her sailors were willing to take the Ak stone fares down to Gast. She shrugged. "It's part of the agreement," she said, evidently not having thought much about it. After thinking, she added, "Be an awful job to drag that stone overland through the marshes." Before the Dako boats have sailed halfway back to the harbor mouth, the Ak have begun loading the stone onto wheeled flatbed carts left on the docks of Gast by the last stone fairing. Then they get into harness and haul these carts 500 kilometers inland and 3,000 meters upward. They go at most 3 or 4 kilometers a day. They encamp before evening and fan out from the trails to forage and set snares for Hikiki, since by now their supplies are low. The cart train follows the least recently used of the several winding trails, because the hunting and gathering will be better along it. During the sea voyages and at Rakim, the mood of the stonefarers tends to be solemn and tense. They are not sailors, and the labor at the quarries is hard and driven. Hauling carts by shoulder harness is certainly not light work either, but the pilgrims take it merrily. They talk and joke while hauling, share their food and sit talking around their campfires, and behave like any group of people engaged willingly in an arduous joint enterprise. They discuss which path to take and wheel mending techniques and so on. But when I went with them, I never heard them talk in the larger sense about what they were doing, their journey's goal. All the paths finally have to surmount the cliffs at the edge of the plateau. As the stonefarers come up onto the level after that terrible last grade, they stop and gaze to the southeast. One after another, the long flat carts laden with dusty stone buck and jerk up over the rim and stop. The haulers stand in harness, gazing silent at the building. After hundreds of years of the slow recovery of the shattered ecosystem, enough Ak began to have enough food to have enough energy for activities beyond forage and storage. It was then, when bare survival was still chancy, that they began the stonefaring. So few of them, in such an inimical world, the atmosphere damaged, the great cycles of life not yet reestablished in the poisoned and despoiled oceans, the lands full of bones, ghosts, ruins, dead forests, deserts of salt, of sand, of chemical waste. How did the inhabitants of such a world think of undertaking such a task? How did they know the stone they wanted was at Rakim? How did they know where Rakim was? Did they originally make their way there somehow without Dako boats and navigators? The origins of the stone fairing are absolutely mysterious, but no more mysterious than its object. All we know is that every stone in the building comes from the quarries of Rakim, and that the Ok have been building it for over 3,000, perhaps 4,000 years. It is immense, of course. It covers many acres and contains thousands of rooms, passages, and courts. It is certainly one of the largest edifices, perhaps the largest single one, on any world we know. And yet declarations of size, counts and measures, comparisons and superlatives are meaningless. The fact is, a technology such as that of contemporary Earth or the ancient Dako could build a building 10 times bigger in 10 years. It is possible that the ever-increasing vastness of the building is a metaphor or illustration of precisely such a factual enormity. Or the building's size may be purely a result of its age. The oldest sections, far inside its outermost walls, show no indication that they were, or were not, seen as the beginning of something immense. They are exactly like the Ok children's houses on a larger scale. All the rest of the building has been added on, year by year, to this modest beginning, in much the same style. After perhaps some centuries, the builders began to add stories onto the flat roofs of the early building, but have never gone above 4 stories, except for towers and pinnacles, and the airy barrel domes that reach a height of perhaps 60 meters. The great bulk of the building is no more than 5 to 6 meters high. Inevitably, it has kept growing outwards, laterally, by way of ells and wings and joining arcades and courtyards, until it covers so vast an area that from a distance it looks like a fantastic terrain, a low mountain landscape all in silvery green stone. Although not dwarfish like the children's structures, curiously enough, the building is not quite full scale, taking the average height of an Ok as measure. The ceilings are barely high enough to allow them to stand straight, and they must stoop to pass through the doors. No part of the building is ruined or in disrepair, though occasional earthquakes shake the Madero Plateau. Damaged areas are repaired annually or mined for a stone to rebuild with. The work is fine, careful, sure, and delicate. No material is used but Rickamite, mortised and tenoned like wood, or set in exquisitely fitted blocks and courses. The indoor surfaces are mostly finished satin smooth, the outer faces left in contrasting degrees of roughness and smoothness. There is no carving or ornamentation other than thin mouldings or incised lines repeating and outlining the architectural shapes. Windows are unglazed stone lattices or pierced stone sheets cut so thin as to be translucent. The repetitive rectangular designs of the latticework are elegantly proportioned. A ratio of 3 to 2 runs through many, though not all, of the building's rooms and apertures. Doors are thin stone slabs, so well balanced and pivoted that they swing lightly and smoothly open and shut. There are no furnishings. Empty rooms, empty corridors, miles of corridors, endlessly similar stairways, ramps, courtyards, roof terraces, delicate towers, vistas of roof beyond roof, tower beyond tower, dome beyond dome to the far distance. High rooms lighted by great lacework windows, or only by the dim greenish mottled translucency of window panes of stone. Corridors that lead to other corridors, other rooms, stairs, ramps, courtyards, corridors. Is it a maze? A labyrinth? Yes, inevitably. But is that what it was built to be? Is it beautiful? Yes, in a way, wonderfully beautiful. But is that what it was built to be? The Ok are a rational species. They have language. Answers to these questions must come from them. The troubling thing is that they have many different answers, none of which seems quite satisfying to them or anyone else. In this, they resemble any reasonable being who does an unreasonable thing and justifies it with reasons. War, for example. My species has a great many good reasons for making war, though none of them is as good as the reason for not making war. Our most rational and scientific justifications, for instance, that we are an aggressive species, are perfectly circular. We make war because we make war. Our justifications for making a particular war, such as our people must have more land and more wealth, or our people must have more power, or our people must obey our deity's orders to crush the sacrilegious infidel, all come down to the same thing. We must make war because we must. We have no choice. We have no freedom. This argument is not ultimately satisfactory to the reasoning mind, which desires freedom. In the same way, the efforts of the Ock to explain or justify their building and their building all invoke a necessity which doesn't seem all that necessary and use reasons which meet themselves coming around. We go stone-faring because we have always done it. We go to Rikim because the best stone is there. The building is on the Madeira because the ground's good and there's room for it there. The building is a great undertaking which our children can look forward to and our men and women can work together on. The stone-faring brings people from all our villages together. We were only a poor, scattered people in the old days, but now the building shows that there is a great vision in us. All these reasons make sense, but don't convince, don't satisfy. Perhaps the questions should be asked of those Ock who never have gone stone-faring. They don't question the stone-faring. They speak of the stone-farers as people doing something brave, difficult, worthy, perhaps sacred. So why have you never gone yourself? Well, I never felt the need to. People who go, they have to go. They're called to it. What about the other people, the Dako? What do they think about this immense structure, certainly the greatest enterprise and achievement on their world at this time? Very little, evidently. Even the sailors of the stone-faring never go up onto the Madeira and know nothing about the building except that it is there and is very large. Dako of the Northwest Continent know it only as rumor, fable, travelers' tales of the palace of the Madeira on the great South Continent. Some tales say the king of the Ock lives there in unimaginable splendor. Some say that it is a tower taller than the mountains in which eyeless monsters dwell. Others that it is a maze where the unwary traveler is lost in endless corridors full of bones and ghosts. Others that the winds blowing through it moan in huge chords like a vast Aeolian harp, which can be heard for hundreds of miles, and so on. To the Dako, it is a legend, like their own legends of the ancient times, when their mighty ancestors flew in the air and drank rivers dry and turned forests into stone and built towers taller than the sky, and so on. Fairy tales. Now and then an Ock who has been stone-faring will say something different about the building. If asked about it, some of them reply, "It is for the Dako." Indeed, the building is better proportioned to the short stature of the Dako than to the tall Ock. The Dako, if they ever went there, could walk through the corridors and doorways upright. An old woman of Katas, who had been 5 times a stone-farer, was the first who gave me that answer. "The building is for the Dako," I said, taken aback. "But why?" "Because of the old days." "But they never go there." "It isn't finished," she said. "A retribution?" I asked, puzzling at it. "A recompense?" "They need it," she said. "The Dako need it, but you don't?" "No," the old woman said with a smile. "We build it. We don't need it."